long been known to exert fascinatingly insidious influences on their hosts. A species of microscopic protozoan parasite called Nosema, which infests the larvae of flower beetles, has discovered how to manufacture a chemical that is very special for the beetles. Like other insects, these beetles have a hormone called the juvenile hormone, which keeps larvae as larvae. The normal change from larva to adult is triggered by the larva ceasing production of juvenile hormone. The parasite Nosema has succeeded in synthesizing a close chemical analogue of this hormone. Millions of Nosema club together to mass-produce juvenile hormone in the beetle larva's body, thereby preventing it from turning into an adult. Instead, it goes on growing, ending up as a giant larva, more than twice the weight of a normal adult. No good for propagating beetle genes, but a cornucopia for Nosema parasites. Giantism in beetle larvae is an extended phenotypic effect of protozoan genes. And here is a case history to provoke even more Freudian anxiety than the Peter Pan beetles: parasitic castration. Crabs are parasitized by a creature called Saculina. Saculina is related to barnacles, though you would think, to look at it, that it was a parasitic plant. It drives an elaborate root system deep into the tissues of the unfortunate crab and sucks nourishment from its body. It is probably no accident that among the first organs that it attacks are the crab's testicles, or ovaries. It spares the organs that the crab needs to survive, as opposed to reproduce, till later. The crab is effectively castrated by the parasite. Like a fattened bullock, the castrated crab diverts energy and resources away from reproduction and into its own body, rich pickings for the parasite at the expense of the crab's reproduction. Very much the same story as we conjectured for Nosema in the flower beetle and for the fluke in the snail. In all three cases, the changes in the host, if we accept that they are Darwinian adaptations for the benefit of the parasite, must be seen as extended phenotypic effects of parasite genes. Genes, then, reach outside their own body to influence phenotypes in other bodies.
To quite a large extent, the interests of parasite genes and host genes may coincide. From the selfish gene point of view, we can think of both fluke genes and snail genes as parasites in the snail body. Both gain from being surrounded by the same protective shell, though they diverge from one another in the precise thickness of shell that they prefer. This divergence arises fundamentally from the fact that their method of leaving this snail's body and entering another one is different. For the snail genes, the method of leaving is via snail sperms or eggs. For the fluke's genes, it is very different. Without going into the details, they are distractingly complicated, what matters is that their genes do not leave the snail's body in the snail's sperms or eggs. I suggest that the most important question to ask about any parasite is this: are its genes transmitted to future generations via the same vehicles as the host's genes? If they are not, I would expect it to damage the host in one way or another. But if they are, the parasite will do all that it can to help the host, not only to survive, but to reproduce. Over evolutionary time, it will cease to be a parasite, will cooperate with the host, and may eventually merge into the host tissues and become unrecognizable as a parasite at all. Maybe, as I suggested in Chapter 10, our cells have come far across this evolutionary spectrum. We are all relics of ancient parasitic mergers.
Look at what can happen when parasite genes and host genes do share a common exit. Wood-boring ambrosia beetles of the species Xyloborus ferruginous are parasitized by bacteria that not only live in their host's body, but also use the host's eggs as their transport into a new host. The genes of such parasites therefore stand to gain from almost exactly the same future circumstances as the genes of their host. The two sets of genes can be expected to pull together for just the same reasons as all the genes of one individual organism normally pull together. it is irrelevant that some of them happen to be beetle genes, while others happen to be bacterial genes. Both sets of genes are interested in beetle survival and the propagation of beetle eggs because both see beetle eggs as their passport to the future. So the bacterial genes share a common destiny with their host genes, and in our interpretation, we should expect the bacteria to cooperate with their beetles in all aspects of life. It turns out that cooperate is putting it mildly. The service they perform for the beetles could hardly be more intimate. These beetles happen to be haplodiploid, like the bees and ants we met in Chapter 10. If an egg is fertilized by a male, it always develops into a female. An unfertilized egg develops into a male. Males, in other words, have no father. The eggs that give rise to them develop spontaneously, without being penetrated by a sperm. But unlike the eggs of bees and ants, ambrosia beetle eggs do need to be penetrated by something. This is where the bacteria come in. They prick the unfertilized eggs into action, provoking them to develop into male beetles. These bacteria are, of course, just the kind of parasites that, we could argue, should cease to be parasitic and become mutualistic, precisely because they are transmitted in the eggs of the host, together with the host's own genes. Ultimately, their own bodies are likely to disappear, merging into the host body completely.
A revealing spectrum can still be found today among species of Hydra, small sedentary tentacled animals like freshwater sea anemones. Their tissues tend to be parasitized by algae. By the way, the G should be pronounced hard. For unknown reasons, some biologists, not least in America, have recently taken to saying algae, as in Algernon, not only for the plural algae, which is just forgivable, but also for the singular algar, which is not. In the species Hydra vulgaris and Hydra attenuata, the algae are real parasites of the hydras, making them ill. In Chlorohydra viridissima, on the other hand, the algae are never absent from the tissues of the hydras and make a useful contribution to their well-being, providing them with oxygen. Now, here is the interesting point. Just as we should expect, in Chlorohydra, the algae transmit themselves to the next generation by means of the hydra's egg. In the other two species, they do not. The interests of alga genes and chlorohydra genes coincide. Both are interested in doing everything in their power to increase production of chlorohydra eggs. But the genes of the other two species of hydra do not agree with the genes of their algae, not to the same extent anyway. Both sets of genes may have an interest in the survival of hydra bodies, but only hydra genes care about hydra reproduction. So the algae hang on as debilitating parasites rather than evolving towards benign cooperation. The key point, to repeat it, is that a parasite whose genes aspire to the same destiny as the genes of its host shares all the interests of its host and will eventually cease to act parasitically. Destiny, in this case, means future generations. Chlorohydra genes and alga genes, beetle genes and bacteria genes can get into the future only via the host's eggs. Therefore, whatever calculations the parasite genes make about optimal policy in any department of life will converge on exactly, or nearly exactly, the same optimal policy as similar calculations made by host genes. In the case of the snail and its fluke parasites, we decided that their preferred shell thicknesses were divergent. In the case of the ambrosia beetle and its bacteria, host and parasite will agree in preferring the same wing length and every other feature of the beetle's body. We can predict this without knowing any details of exactly what the beetles might use their wings or anything else for. We can predict it simply from our reasoning that both the beetle genes and the bacterial genes will take whatever steps lie in their power to engineer the same future events, events favourable to the propagation of beetle eggs.
We can take this argument to its logical conclusion and apply it to normal own genes. Our own genes cooperate with one another, not because they are our own, but because they share the same outlet, sperm or egg, into the future. If any genes of an organism, such as a human, could discover a way of spreading themselves that did not depend on the conventional sperm or egg route, they would take it and be less cooperative. This is because they would stand to gain by a different set of future outcomes from the other genes in the body. We've already seen examples of genes that bias meiosis in their own favour. Perhaps there are also genes that have broken out of the sperm-egg proper channels altogether and pioneered a sideways route. There are fragments of DNA that are not incorporated in chromosomes, but float freely and multiply in the fluid contents of cells, especially bacterial cells. They go under various names, such as viroids or plasmids. A plasmid is even smaller than a virus, and it normally consists of only a few genes. Some plasmids are capable of splicing themselves seamlessly into a chromosome. So smooth is the splice that you can't see the join. The plasmid is indistinguishable from any other part of the chromosome. The same plasmids can also cut themselves out again. This ability of DNA to cut and splice, to jump in and out of chromosomes at the drop of a hat, is one of the more exciting facts that have come to light since the first edition of this book was published. Indeed, the recent evidence on plasmids can be seen as beautiful supporting evidence for our earlier conjectures about the paradoxical surplus of parasitic DNA, which seemed a bit wild in 1976.
From some points of view, it does not really matter whether these fragments originated as invading parasites or breakaway rebels. Their likely behaviour will be the same. I shall talk about a breakaway fragment in order to emphasise my point. Consider a rebel stretch of human DNA that is capable of snipping itself out of its chromosome, floating freely in the cell, perhaps multiplying itself up into many copies, and then splicing itself into another chromosome. What unorthodox alternative routes into the future could such a rebel replicator exploit? We are losing cells continually from our skin. Much of the dust in our houses consists of our sloughed-off cells. We must be breathing in one another's cells all the time. If you draw your fingernail across the inside of your mouth, it will come away with hundreds of living cells. The kisses and caresses of lovers must transfer multitudes of cells both ways. A stretch of rebel DNA could hitch a ride in any of these cells. If genes could discover a chink of an unorthodox route through to another body, alongside or instead of the orthodox sperm or egg route, we must expect natural selection to favour their opportunism and improve it. As for the precise methods that they use, there is no reason why they should be any different from the machinations, all too predictable to a selfish gene-extended phenotype theorist, of viruses. When we have a cold or a cough, we normally think of the symptoms as annoying byproducts of the virus's activities. But in some cases it seems more probable that they are deliberately engineered by the virus to help it to travel from one host to another. Not content with simply being breathed into the atmosphere, the virus makes us sneeze or cough explosively. The rabies virus is transmitted in saliva when one animal bites another. In dogs, one of the symptoms of the disease is that normally peaceful and friendly animals become ferocious biters, foaming at the mouth. Ominously, too, instead of staying within a mile or so of home like normal dogs, they turn into restless wanderers, propagating the virus far afield. It has even been suggested that the well-known hydrophobic symptom encourages the dog to shake the wet foam from its mouth, and with it the virus. I do not know of any direct evidence that sexually transmitted diseases increase the libido of sufferers, but I conjecture that it would be worth looking into. Certainly at least one alleged aphrodisiac, Spanish fly, is said to work by inducing an itch, and making people itch is just the kind of thing viruses are good at. The point of comparing rebel human DNA with invading parasitic viruses is that there really isn't any important difference between them. Viruses may well indeed have originated as collections of breakaway genes. If we want to erect any distinction, it should be between genes that pass from body to body via the orthodox route of sperms or eggs, and genes that pass from body to body via unorthodox, sideways routes. Both classes may include genes that originated as own chromosomal genes, and both classes may include genes that originated as external, invading parasites. Or perhaps, as I speculated, all own chromosomal genes should be regarded as mutually parasitic on one another. The important difference between my two classes of genes lies in the divergent circumstances from which they stand to benefit in the future. A cold virus gene and a breakaway human chromosomal gene agree with one another in wanting their host to sneeze. An orthodox chromosomal gene and a venereally transmitted virus agree with one another in wanting their host to copulate. It is an intriguing thought that both would want the host to be sexually attractive. More, an orthodox chromosomal gene and a virus that is transmitted inside the host's egg would agree in wanting the host to succeed not just in its courtship, but in every detailed aspect of its life, down to being a loyal, doting parent and even grandparent.
The caddis lives inside its house, and the parasites that we have so far discussed have lived inside their hosts. The genes, then, are physically close to their extended phenotypic effects, as close as genes ordinarily are to their conventional phenotypes. But genes can act at a distance. Extended phenotypes can extend a long way. One of the longest spans a lake. Like a spider web or a caddis house, a beaver dam is among the true wonders of the world. It's not entirely clear what its Darwinian purpose is, but it certainly must have one, for the beavers expend so much time and energy to build it. The lake that it creates probably serves to protect the beaver's lodge from predators. It also provides a convenient waterway for travelling and for transporting logs. Beavers use flotation for the same reason as Canadian lumber companies use rivers and 18th century coal merchants use canals. Whatever its benefits, a beaver lake is a conspicuous and characteristic feature of the landscape. It is a phenotype, no less than the beaver's teeth and tail, and it has evolved under the influence of Darwinian selection. Darwinian selection has to have genetic variation to work on. Here the choice must have been between good lakes and less good lakes. Selection favoured beaver genes that made good lakes for transporting trees, just as it favoured genes that made good teeth for felling them. Beaver lakes are extended phenotypic effects of beaver genes, and they can extend over several hundreds of yards, a long reach indeed. Parasites, too, don't have to live inside their hosts. Their genes can express themselves in hosts at a distance. Cuckoo nestlings don't live inside robins or reed warblers. They don't suck their blood or devour their tissues, yet we have no hesitation in labelling them as parasites. Cuckoo adaptations to manipulate the behaviour of foster parents can be looked upon as extended phenotypic action at a distance by cuckoo genes.
It is easy to empathise with foster parents duped into incubating the cuckoo's eggs. Human egg collectors, too, have been fooled by the uncanny resemblance of cuckoo eggs to, say, meadow pipit eggs or reed warbler eggs. Different races of female cuckoos specialise in different host species. What is harder to understand is the behaviour of foster parents later in the season towards young cuckoos that are almost fledged. The cuckoo is usually much larger, in some cases grotesquely larger, than its parent. I'm looking at a photograph of an adult dunnock, so small in comparison to its monstrous foster child that it has to perch on its back in order to feed it. Here we feel less sympathy for the host. We marvel at its stupidity, its gullibility. Surely any fool should be able to see that there is something wrong with a child like that. I think that cuckoo nestlings must be doing rather more than just fooling their hosts, more than just pretending to be something that they aren't. They seem to act on the host's nervous system in rather the same way as an addictive drug. This is not so hard to sympathize with, even for those with no experience of addictive drugs. A man can be aroused even to erection by a printed photograph of a woman's body. He's not fooled into thinking that the pattern of printing ink really is a woman. He knows that he's only looking at ink on paper, yet his nervous system responds to it in the same kind of way as it might respond to a real woman. We may find the attractions of a particular member of the opposite sex irresistible, even though the better judgment of our better self tells us that a liaison with that person is not in anyone's long-term interests. The same can be true of the irresistible attractions of unhealthy food. The Dunnock probably has no conscious awareness of its long-term best interests, so it is even easier to understand that its nervous system might find certain kinds of stimulation irresistible.
So enticing is the red gape of a cuckoo nestling that it's not uncommon for ornithologists to see a bird dropping food into the mouth of a baby cuckoo sitting in some other bird's nest. A bird may be flying home, carrying food for its own young. Suddenly, out of the corner of its eye, it sees the red super gape of a young cuckoo in the nest of a bird of some quite different species. It is diverted to the alien nest, where it drops into the cuckoo's mouth the food that had been destined for its own young. The irresistibility theory fits with the views of early German ornithologists, who referred to foster parents as behaving like addicts, and to the cuckoo nestling as their vice. It's only fair to add that this kind of language finds less favour with some modern experimenters. But there's no doubt that if we do assume that the cuckoo's gape is a powerful drug-like superstimulus, it becomes very much easier to explain what is going on. It becomes easier to sympathise with the behaviour of the diminutive parent standing on the back of its monstrous child. It's not being stupid. Fooled is the wrong word to use. Its nervous system is being controlled as irresistibly as if it were a helpless drug addict, or as if the cuckoo were a scientist plugging electrodes into its brain. But even if we now feel more personal sympathy for the manipulated foster parent, we can still ask why natural selection has allowed the cuckoos to get away with it. Why haven't host nervous systems evolved resistance to the red gape drug? Maybe selection hasn't yet had time to do its work. Perhaps cuckoos have only in recent centuries started parasitizing their present hosts, and will in a few centuries be forced to give them up and victimize other species. There is some evidence to support this theory. But there is more to it than that.
In the evolutionary arms race between cuckoos and any host species, there is a sort of built-in unfairness resulting from unequal costs of failure. Each individual cuckoo nestling is descended from a long line of ancestral cuckoo nestlings, every single one of whom must have succeeded in manipulating its foster parent. Any cuckoo nestling that lost its hold even momentarily over its host would have died as a result. But each individual foster parent is descended from a long line of ancestors, many of whom never encountered a cuckoo in their lives. And those that did have a cuckoo in their nest could have succumbed to it and still lived to rear another brood next season. The point is that there is an asymmetry in the cost of failure. Genes for failure to resist enslavement by cuckoos can easily be passed down the generations of robins or dunnocks. Genes for failure to enslave foster parents cannot be passed down the generations of cuckoos. This is what I meant by built-in unfairness, and by asymmetry in the cost of failure. The point is summed up in one of Aesop's fables. The rabbit runs faster than the fox, because the rabbit is running for his life, while the fox is only running for his dinner. My colleague John Krebs and I have dubbed this the life-dinner principle. Because of the life-dinner principle, animals might at times behave in ways that are not in their own best interests, manipulated by some other animal. Actually, in a sense, they are acting in their own best interests. The whole point of the life-dinner principle is that they theoretically could resist manipulation, but it would be too costly to do so. Perhaps to resist manipulation by a cuckoo, you need bigger eyes or a bigger brain, which would have overhead costs. Rivals with a genetic tendency to resist manipulation would actually be less successful in passing on genes, because of the economic costs of resisting.
But we have once again slipped back into looking at life from the point of view of the individual organism rather than its genes. When we talked about flukes and snails, we accustomed ourselves to the idea that a parasite's genes could have phenotypic effects on the host's body in exactly the same way as any animal's genes have phenotypic effects on its own body. We showed that the very idea of an own body was a loaded assumption. In one sense, all the genes in a body are parasitic genes, whether we like to call them the body's own genes or not. Cuckoos came into the discussion as an example of parasites not living inside the bodies of their hosts. They manipulate their hosts in much the same way as internal parasites do, and the manipulation, as we've now seen, can be as powerful and irresistible as any internal drug or hormone. As in the case of internal parasites, we should now rephrase the whole matter in terms of genes and extended phenotypes. In the evolutionary arms race between cuckoos and hosts, advances on each side took the form of genetic mutations arising and being favoured by natural selection. Whatever it is about the cuckoo's gape that acts like a drug on the host's nervous system, it must have originated as a genetic mutation. This mutation worked via its effect on, say, the colour and shape of the young cuckoo's gape. But even this was not its most immediate effect. Its most immediate effect was upon unseen chemical happenings inside cells. The effect of genes on colour and shape of gape is itself indirect. And now here is the point. Only a little more indirect is the effect of the same cuckoo genes on the behaviour of the besotted host, in exactly the same sense as we may speak of cuckoo genes having phenotypic effects on the colour and shape of cuckoo gapes. So we may speak of cuckoo genes having extended phenotypic effects on host behaviour. Parasite genes can have effects on host bodies, not just when the parasite lives inside the host, where it can manipulate by direct chemical means, but when the parasite is quite separate from the host and manipulates it from a distance. Indeed, as we are about to see, even chemical influences can act outside the body. Cuckoos are remarkable and instructive creatures. But almost any wonder among the vertebrates can be surpassed by the insects. They have the advantage that there are just so many of them. My colleague Robert May has aptly observed that, to a good approximation, all species are insects. Insect cuckoos defy listing. They are so numerous and their habit has been reinvented so often. Some examples that we'll look at have gone beyond familiar cuckooism to fulfil the wildest fantasies that the extended phenotype might have inspired.
A bird cuckoo deposits her egg and disappears. Some ant cuckoo females make their presence felt in more dramatic fashion. I don't often give Latin names, but Bothrio myrmex regicidus and B. decapitans tell a story. These two species are both parasites on other species of ants. Among all ants, of course, the young are normally fed not by parents but by workers, so it is workers that any would-be cuckoo must fool or manipulate. A useful first step is to dispose of the worker's own mother with her propensity to produce competing brood. In these two species, the parasite queen, all alone, steals into the nest of another ant species. She seeks out the host queen and rides about on her back while she quietly performs, to quote Edward Wilson's artfully macabre understatement, the one act for which she is uniquely specialized, slowly cutting off the head of her victim. The murderess is then adopted by the orphaned workers who unsuspectingly tend her eggs and larvae. Some are nurtured into workers themselves, who gradually replace the original species in the nest. Others become queens, who fly out to seek pastures new and royal heads yet unsevered. But sawing off heads is a bit of a chore. Parasites are not accustomed to exerting themselves if they can coerce a stand-in. My favourite character in Wilson's book, The Insect Societies, is Monomorium sanchii. This species, over evolutionary time, has lost its worker caste altogether. The host workers do everything for their parasites, even the most terrible task of all. At the behest of the invading parasite queen, they actually perform the deed of murdering their own mother. The usurper doesn't need to use her jaws, she uses mind control. How she does it is a mystery. She probably employs a chemical, for ant nervous systems are generally highly attuned to them. If her weapon is indeed chemical, then it is as insidious a drug as any known to science. For think what it accomplishes. It floods the brain of the worker ant, grabs the reins of her muscles, woos her from deeply ingrained duties, and turns her against her own mother. For ants, matricide is an act of special genetic madness, and formidable indeed must be the drug that drives them to it. In the world of the extended phenotype, ask not how an animal's behavior benefits its genes. Ask instead whose genes it is benefiting.
It is hardly surprising that ants are exploited by parasites, not just other ants, but an astonishing menagerie of specialist hangers-on. Worker ants sweep a rich flow of food from a wide catchment area into a central hoard, which is a sitting target for freeloaders. Ants are also good agents of protection. They are well-armed and numerous. The aphids of Chapter 10 could be seen as paying out nectar to hire professional bodyguards. Several butterfly species live out their caterpillar stage inside an ant's nest. Some are straightforward pillagers. Others offer something to the ants in return for protection. Often they bristle, literally, with equipment for manipulating their protectors. The caterpillar of a butterfly called Thisbe irenia has a sound-producing organ in its head for summoning ants and a pair of telescopic spouts near its rear end which exude seductive nectar. On its shoulders stands another pair of nozzles which cast an altogether more subtle spell. Their secretion seems to be not food, but a volatile potion that has a dramatic impact upon the ant's behaviour. An ant coming under the influence leaps clear into the air, its jaws open wide and it turns aggressive, far more eager than usual to attack, bite and sting any moving object. Except, significantly, the caterpillar responsible for drugging it. Moreover, an ant under the sway of a dope-peddling caterpillar eventually enters a state called binding, in which it becomes inseparable from its caterpillar for a period of many days. Like an aphid, then, the caterpillar employs ants as bodyguards, but it goes one better. Whereas aphids rely on the ant's normal aggression against predators, the caterpillar administers an aggression-arousing drug, and it seems to slip them something addictively binding as well.
I have chosen extreme examples. But in more modest ways, nature teems with animals and plants that manipulate others of the same or of different species. In all cases in which natural selection has favoured genes for manipulation, it is legitimate to speak of those same genes as having extended phenotypic effects on the body of the manipulated organism. It doesn't matter in which body a gene physically sits. The target of its manipulation may be the same body or a different one. Natural selection favours those genes that manipulate the world to ensure their own propagation. This leads to what I have called the central theorem of the extended phenotype.
An animal's behaviour tends to maximise the survival of the genes for that behaviour, whether or not those genes happen to be in the body of the particular animal performing it.
I was writing in the context of animal behaviour, but the theorem could apply, of course, to colour, size, shape, to anything. It is finally time to return to the problem with which we started, to the tension between individual organism and gene as rival candidates for the central role in natural selection. In earlier chapters, I made the assumption that there was no problem because individual reproduction was equivalent to gene survival. I assume there that you can say either the organism works to propagate all its genes, or the genes work to force a succession of organisms to propagate them. They seemed like two equivalent ways of saying the same thing, and which form of words you chose seemed a matter of taste. But somehow the tension remained. One way of sorting this whole matter out is to use the terms replicator and vehicle. The fundamental units of natural selection, the basic things that survive or fail to survive, that form lineages of identical copies with occasional random mutations, are called replicators. DNA molecules are replicators. They generally, for reasons that we shall come to, gang together in large communal survival machines or vehicles. The vehicles that we know best are individual bodies like our own. A body, then, is not a replicator. It is a vehicle. I must emphasize this since the point has been misunderstood. Vehicles don't replicate themselves. They work to propagate their replicators. Replicators don't behave, don't perceive the world, don't catch prey or run away from predators. They make vehicles that do all those things. For many purposes, it is convenient for biologists to focus their attention at the level of the vehicle. For other purposes, it is convenient for them to focus their attention at the level of the replicator. Gene and individual organism are not rivals for the same starring role in the Darwinian drama. They are cast in different, complementary, and in many respects equally important roles, the role of replicator and the role of vehicle.
The replicator-vehicle terminology is helpful in various ways. For instance, it clears up a tiresome controversy over the level at which natural selection acts. Superficially, it might seem logical to place individual selection on a sort of ladder of levels of selection, halfway between the gene selection advocated in Chapter 3 and the group selection criticized in Chapter 7. Individual selection seems vaguely to be a middle way between two extremes, and many biologists and philosophers have been seduced into this facile path. But we can now see that it isn't like that at all. We can now see that the organism and the group of organisms are true rivals for the vehicle role in the story, but neither of them is even a candidate for the replicator role. The controversy between individual selection and group selection is a real controversy between alternative vehicles. The controversy between individual selection and gene selection isn't a controversy at all, for gene and organism are candidates for different and complementary roles in the story, the replicator and the vehicle.
The rivalry between individual organism and group of organisms for the vehicle role, being a real rivalry, can be settled. As it happens, the outcome, in my view, is a decisive victory for the individual organism. The group is too wishy-washy an entity. A herd of deer, a pride of lions, or a pack of wolves has a certain rudimentary coherence and unity of purpose, but this is paltry in comparison to the coherence and unity of purpose of the body of an individual lion, wolf, or deer. That this is true is now widely accepted, but why is it true? Extended phenotypes and parasites can again help us. We saw that when the genes of a parasite work together with each other, but in opposition to the genes of the host, which all work together with each other, it is because the two sets of genes have different methods of leaving the shared vehicle, the host's body. Snail genes leave the shared vehicle by snail sperm and eggs. Because all snail genes have an equal stake in every sperm and every egg, because they all participate in the same unpartisan meiosis, they work together for the common good, and therefore tend to make the snail body a coherent, purposeful vehicle. The real reason why a fluke is recognizably separate from its host, the reason why it doesn't merge its purposes and its identity with the purposes and identity of the host, is that the fluke genes don't share the snail genes method of leaving the shared vehicle, and don't share in the snail's meiotic lottery. They have a lottery of their own. Therefore, to that extent, and that extent only, the two vehicles remain separated as a snail and a recognizably distinct fluke inside it. If fluke genes were passed on in snail eggs and sperms, the two bodies would evolve to become as one flesh. We mightn't even be able to tell that there ever had been two vehicles.
Single, individual organisms such as ourselves are the ultimate embodiment of many such mergers. The group of organisms, the flock of birds, the pack of wolves, does not merge into a single vehicle precisely because the genes in the flock or the pack do not share a common method of leaving the present vehicle. To be sure, packs may bud off daughter packs, but the genes in the parent pack don't pass to the daughter pack in a single vessel in which all have an equal share. The genes in a pack of wolves don't all stand to gain from the same set of events in the future. A gene can foster its own future welfare by favouring its own individual wolf at the expense of other individual wolves. An individual wolf, therefore, is a vehicle worthy of the name. A pack of wolves is not. Genetically speaking, the reason for this is that all the cells except the sex cells in a wolf's body have the same genes, while as for the sex cells, all the genes have an equal chance of being in each one of them. But the cells in a pack of wolves do not have the same genes, nor do they have the same chance of being in the cells of sub-packs that are budded off. They have everything to gain by struggling against rivals in other wolf bodies, although the fact that a wolf pack is likely to be a kin group will mitigate the struggle. The essential quality that an entity needs if it is to become an effective gene vehicle is this. It must have an impartial exit channel into the future for all the genes inside it. This is true of an individual wolf. The channel is the thin stream of sperms or eggs which it manufactures by meiosis. It is not true of the pack of wolves. Genes have something to gain from selfishly promoting the welfare of their own individual bodies at the expense of other genes in the wolf pack. A beehive, when it swarms, appears to reproduce by broad-fronted budding like a wolf pack. But if we look more carefully, we find that, as far as the genes are concerned, their destiny is largely shared. The future of the genes in the swarm is, at least to a large extent, lodged in the ovaries of one queen. That is why, it's just another way of expressing the message of earlier chapters, the bee colony looks and behaves like a truly integrated single vehicle.
Everywhere we find that life, as a matter of fact, is bundled into discrete, individually purposeful vehicles, like wolves and beehives. But the doctrine of the extended phenotype has taught us that it needn't have been so. Fundamentally, all that we have a right to expect from our theory is a battleground of replicators, jostling, jockeying, fighting for a future in the genetic hereafter. The weapons in the fight are phenotypic effects, initially direct chemical effects in cells, but eventually feathers and fangs, and even more remote effects. It undeniably happens to be the case that these phenotypic effects have largely become bundled up into discrete vehicles, each with its genes disciplined and ordered by the prospect of a shared bottleneck of sperms or eggs funneling them into the future. But this is not a fact to be taken for granted. It is a fact to be questioned and wondered at in its own right. Why did genes come together into large vehicles, each with a single genetic exit route? Why did genes choose to gang up and make large bodies for themselves to live in? In the extended phenotype, I attempted to work out an answer to this difficult problem. Here I can sketch only a part of that answer, although, as might be expected, since 7 years have passed since I wrote it, I can now also take it a little further. I shall divide the question up into three. Why did genes gang up in cells? Why did cells gang up in many-celled bodies? And why did bodies adopt what I shall call a bottlenecked life cycle? First then, why did genes gang up in cells? Why did those ancient replicators give up the cavalier freedom of the primeval soup and take to swarming in huge colonies? Why do they cooperate? We can see part of the answer by looking at how modern DNA molecules cooperate in the chemical factories that are living cells. DNA molecules make proteins. Proteins work as enzymes, catalyzing particular chemical reactions. Often a single chemical reaction is not sufficient to synthesize a useful end product. In a human pharmaceutical factory, the synthesis of a useful chemical needs a production line. The starting chemical cannot be transformed directly into the desired end product. A series of intermediates must be synthesized in strict sequence. Much of a research chemist's ingenuity goes into devising pathways of feasible intermediates between starting chemicals and desired end products. In the same way, single enzymes in a living cell usually cannot, on their own, achieve the synthesis of a useful end product from a given starting chemical. A whole set of enzymes is necessary, one to catalyze the transformation of the raw material into the first intermediate, another to catalyze the transformation of the first intermediate into the second, and so on.
Each of these enzymes is made by one gene. If a sequence of six enzymes is needed for a particular synthetic pathway, all six genes for making them must be present. Now it is quite likely that there are two alternative pathways for arriving at the same end product, each needing six different enzymes, and with nothing to choose between the two of them. This kind of thing happens in chemical factories. Which pathway is chosen may be historical accident, or it may be a matter of more deliberate planning by chemists. In nature's chemistry, the choice will never, of course, be a deliberate one. Instead, it will come about through natural selection. But how can natural selection see to it that the two pathways are not mixed, and that cooperating groups of compatible genes emerge? In very much the same way as we discussed with the analogy of the German and English rowers in Chapter 5. The important thing is that a gene for a stage in Pathway 1 will flourish in the presence of genes for other stages in Pathway 1, but not in the presence of Pathway 2 genes. If the population already happens to be dominated by genes for Pathway 1, selection will favour other genes for Pathway 1 and penalise genes for Pathway 2, and vice versa. Tempting as it is positively wrong to speak of the genes for the six enzymes of Pathway 2 being selected as a group. Each one is selected as a separate, selfish gene, but it flourishes only in the presence of the right set of other genes. Nowadays, this cooperation between genes goes on within cells. It must have started as rudimentary cooperation between self-replicating molecules in the primeval soup, or whatever primeval medium there was. Cell walls perhaps arose as a device to keep useful chemicals together and stop them leaking away. Many of the chemical reactions in the cell actually go on in the fabric of membranes. A membrane acts as a combined conveyor belt and test tube rack. But cooperation between genes did not stay limited to cellular biochemistry. Cells came together, or failed to separate after cell division, to form many-celled bodies.
This brings us to the second of my three questions. Why did cells gang together? Why the lumbering robots? This is another question about cooperation, but the domain has shifted from the world of molecules to a larger scale. Many cell bodies outgrow the microscope. They can even become elephants or whales. Being big is not necessarily a good thing. Most organisms are bacteria and very few are elephants. But when the ways of making a living that are open to small organisms have all been filled, there are still prosperous livings to be made by larger organisms. Large organisms can eat smaller ones, for instance, and can avoid being eaten by them. The advantages of being a club of cells don't stop with size. The cells in the club can specialize, each thereby becoming more efficient at performing its particular task. Specialist cells serve other cells in the club, and they also benefit from the efficiency of other specialists. If there are many cells, some can specialize as sensors to detect prey, others as nerves to pass on the message, others as stinging cells to paralyze the prey, muscle cells to move tentacles and catch the prey, secretory cells to dissolve it, and yet others to absorb the juices. We must not forget that, at least in modern bodies like our own, the cells are a clone. All contain the same genes, although different genes will be turned on in the different specialist cells. Genes in each cell type are directly benefiting their own copies in the minority of cells specialized for reproduction, the cells of the immortal germline.
So to the third question. Why do bodies participate in a bottlenecked life cycle? To begin with, what do we mean by bottlenecked? No matter how many cells there may be in the body of an elephant, the elephant began life as a single cell, a fertilized egg. The fertilized egg is a narrow bottleneck which, during embryonic development, widens out into the trillions of cells of an adult elephant. And no matter how many cells of no matter how many specialized types cooperate to perform the unimaginably complicated task of running an adult elephant, the efforts of all those cells converge on the final goal of producing single cells again, sperms or eggs. The elephant not only has its beginning in a single cell, a fertilized egg, its end, meaning its goal or end product, is the production of single cells, fertilized eggs of the next generation. The life cycle of the broad and bulky elephant both begins and ends with a narrow bottleneck. This bottlenecking is characteristic of the life cycles of all many-celled animals and most plants. Why? What is its significance? We cannot answer this without considering what life might look without it. It will be helpful to imagine two hypothetical species of seaweed called bottle rack and splurge weed. Splurge weed grows as a set of straggling amorphous branches in the sea. Every now and then branches break off and drift away. These breakages can occur anywhere in the plants, and the fragments can be large or small. As with cuttings in a garden, they are capable of growing just like the original plant. This shedding of parts is the species' method of reproducing. As you will notice, it isn't really different from its method of growing, except that the growing parts become physically detached from one another. Bottle rack looks the same and grows in the same straggly way. There is one crucial difference, however. It reproduces by releasing single-celled spores, which drift off in the sea and grow into new plants. These spores are just cells of the plant like any others. As in the case of splurge weed, no sex is involved. The daughters of a plant consist of cells that are clone mates of the cells of the parent plant. The only difference between the two species is that splurge weed reproduces by hiving off chunks of itself consisting of indeterminate numbers of cells, while bottle rack reproduces by hiving off chunks of itself always consisting of single cells.
By imagining these two kinds of plant, we have zeroed in on the crucial difference between a bottlenecked and an unbottlenecked life cycle. Bottle rack reproduces by squeezing itself every generation through a single-celled bottleneck. Splurge weed just grows and breaks in two. It can hardly be said to possess discrete generations or to consist of discrete organisms at all. What about bottle rack? I'll spell it out soon, but we can already see an inkling of the answer. Doesn't bottle rack already seem to have a more discrete, organism-y feel to it? Splurge weed, as we have seen, reproduces by the same process as it grows. Indeed, it scarcely reproduces at all. Bottle rack, on the other hand, makes a clear separation between growth and reproduction. We may have zeroed in on the difference, but so what? What is the significance of it? Why does it matter? I have thought a long time about this, and I think I know the answer. Incidentally, it was harder to work out that there was a question than to think of the answer. The answer can be divided into three parts, the first two of which have to do with the relationship between evolution and embryonic development. First, think about the problem of evolving a complex organ from a simpler one. We don't have to stay with plants, and for this stage of the argument, it might be better to switch to animals, because they have more obviously complicated organs. Again, there is no need to think in terms of sex. Sexual versus asexual reproduction is a red herring here. We can imagine our animals reproducing by sending off non-sexual spores, single cells that, mutations aside, are genetically identical to one another, and to all the other cells in the body. The complicated organs of an advanced animal like a human or a woodlouse have evolved by gradual degrees from the simpler organs of ancestors. But the ancestral organs did not literally change themselves into the descendant organs, like swords being beaten into plowshares. Not only did they not, the point I want to make is that in most cases they could not. There is only a limited amount of change that can be achieved by direct transformation in the swords to plowshares manner. Really radical change can be achieved only by going back to the drawing board, throwing away the previous design, and starting afresh. When engineers go back to the drawing board and create a new design, they do not necessarily throw away the ideas from the old design, but they don't literally try to deform the old physical object into the new one. The old object is too weighed down with the clutter of history. Maybe you can beat a sword into a plowshare, but try beating a propeller engine into a jet engine. You can't do it. You have to discard the propeller engine and go back to the drawing board. Living things, of course, were never designed on drawing boards, but they do go back to fresh beginnings. They make a clean start in every generation. Every new organism begins as a single cell and grows anew. It inherits the ideas of ancestral design in the form of the DNA program, but it does not inherit the physical organs of its ancestors. It does not inherit its parents' heart and remold it into a new and possibly improved heart. It starts from scratch as a single cell and grows a new heart using the same design program as its parents' heart, to which improvements may be added. You see the conclusion I'm leading up to. One important thing about a bottleneck life cycle is that it makes possible the equivalent of going back to the drawing board.
Bottlenecking of the life cycle has a second related consequence. It provides a calendar that can be used to regulate the processes of embryology. In a bottleneck life cycle, every fresh generation marches through approximately the same parade of events. The organism begins as a single cell. It grows by cell division, and it reproduces by sending out daughter cells. Presumably it eventually dies, but that is less important than it seems to us mortals. As far as this discussion is concerned, the end of the cycle is reached when the present organism reproduces and a new generation's cycle begins. Although in theory the organism could reproduce at any time during its growth phase, we can expect that eventually an optimum time for reproduction would emerge. Organisms that released spores when they were too young or too old would end up with fewer descendants than rivals that built up their strength and then released a massive number of spores when in the prime of life. The argument is moving towards the idea of a stereotyped, regularly repeating life cycle. Not only does each generation begin with a single-celled bottleneck, it also has a growth phase, childhood, of rather fixed duration. The fixed duration, the stereotypy of the growth phase, makes it possible for particular things to happen at particular times during development, as if governed by a strictly observed calendar. To varying extents in different kinds of creature, cell divisions during development occur in rigid sequence, a sequence that recurs in each repetition of the life cycle. Each cell has its own location and time of appearance in the roster of cell divisions. In some cases, incidentally, this is so precise that embryologists can give a name to each cell, and a given cell in one individual organism can be said to have an exact counterpart in another organism. So the stereotyped growth cycle provides a clock, or calendar, by means of which embryological events may be triggered. Think of how readily we ourselves use the cycles of the Earth's daily rotation and its yearly circumnavigation of the Sun to structure and order our lives. In the same way, the endlessly repeated growth rhythms imposed by a bottlenecked life cycle will, it seems almost inevitable, be used to order and structure embryology. Particular genes can be switched on and off at particular times because the bottleneck growth cycle calendar ensures that there is such a thing as a particular time. Such well-tempered regulations of gene activity are a prerequisite for the evolution of embryologies capable of crafting complex tissues and organs. the precision and complexity of an eagle's eye or a swallow's wing couldn't emerge without clockwork rules for what is laid down when.
The third